Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden's Commission on Supreme Court Reform releases some draft materials as the justices kick off their new term with some big arguments on the calendar. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Bill McGurn and Kim Strassel. In the final weeks of the 2020 presidential campaign, the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and then the confirmation of her successor, Amy Coney Barrett, put a big spotlight on the Supreme Court. Candidate Joe Biden was asked time and again about adding seats to the Supreme Court to dilute or eliminate that conservative majority, and he refused to take a position, saying he would appoint a commission to study it. Now, here we are last Friday. That commission released some draft reports. These aren't the final ones, but some draft materials. And Bill, one of the big notable takeaways is how skeptical these reports sound about this idea of creating new Supreme Court seats.
Yes, it does in the argument. However, that's the progressives are not going to be happy with that. Look, when Joe Biden established this commission, this was to put off, you know, a decision, because clearly a lot of his supporters, you know, want to pack the Supreme Court. They're feeling frustrated by the new majority on the Supreme Court, and this was their answer. And he knew that this would be difficult. The irony is that by putting it off, you know, when it was first raised, Joe was riding pretty high in the polls and so forth, his approval. But now his approval ratings are way, way down. He just said yesterday he didn't support term limits, sort of the other halfway house of court packing for people. But I'm going to be curious to see how long he can maintain this, because I don't think the progressives will be satisfied. And I think his low approval ratings mean that he's going to be less confident in confronting the progressive wing of his party.
But it is notable, I think, the language in this report on the question of court packing. It says, I'll read a few lines, the risks of court expansion are considerable. Courts cannot serve as effective checks on government officials if their personnel can be altered by those same government officials. In some countries, alterations of the size of a country's high court has been a worrying sign of democratic backsliding. And it goes on to cite Venezuela and Turkey. Kim, I mean, that is not language. We'll have to see what the final report says, but that is not language that seems even really lukewarm to the idea.
Right. They also noted that this question of whether or not it's better for courts to have ideological balance, they pointed out that it isn't even clear that that's a desirable goal. You add those statements together, and if this is the best that liberal academics can come up with in terms of this agenda progressives want to put forward, it highlights yet again what a radical idea this is, and what a radical idea it even was to have this commission. And I remain highly critical of Biden for even going down this path. Some people said, oh, well, this was his way of kicking the can. But to be clear, the mere existence of a commission like this while the court is gearing up for another term is a form of intimidation. It's this sword out there and another suggestion from the White House and from progressives in Congress that if somehow the court steps out of line, that bad things could happen and it could be potentially altered. So again, I think it's interesting that even though this 36-member commission, which was comprised almost entirely of liberal academics, and I would note that at least a couple of the token conservative members have stepped down, resigned, because they clearly saw a problem with the directions it was headed. Maybe they haven't necessarily given reasons for why they did, but the clear suggestion is they felt as though the direction it was headed or was wrong, or that their views were not being adequately considered as part of the group. But, you know, it says something that even this very liberal commission had to acknowledge the obvious of this point about the independence of the judicial branch, the grave dangers of giving politicians the ability to just change that at will.
Bill, what do you make of this idea that Kim raises, that even going through these motions is something of a corrosive act? I mean, I was struck by a line in the Journal's editorial on this, and it says, at Friday's meeting of the commission, essentially, the University of Chicago's William Bode compared the exercise to a commission exploring the possibility of state legislatures overturning presidential election results, unquote. And I think that's an interesting comparison, because even if the commission said no, state legislatures can't do this. The state legislatures can't have a popular vote for president and then after the fact decide that they're going to change their minds. Even going through those motions, I think, Bill, would be seen as a corrosive attack on democratic norms.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Look, I think the thing that Joe Biden should have done is just kill it at the beginning, because when you allow this to develop, not only do you legitimate at least the idea, the debate, you increase pressure on yourself down the road. Again, I'm not so sure how resistant Joe Biden's going to be in another year or two, because this is something that the progressives want. One of the other things that you sort of alluded, that Kim alluded to, but didn't spell out, you know, there are so many liberals on this commission, but even they managed to oppose it. This is not the opposition to court packing is not simply a conservative idea. There are a lot of liberal jurists and so forth who oppose it. You know, most notably Ruth Bader Ginsburg, 2 years ago, she said she thought 9 was a good number. So, you know, a lot of people, a lot of Democrats, a lot of liberal jurists, they also think it's a bad idea. But when you give it a commission with this official imprimatur and so forth, you know, these things can have a life of their own. And I don't know what the effect will be down the line. But I do know that Joe Biden is in less of a position to resist these kind of things today than he was when he did try to kick the can down the road by establishing this commission a few months ago.
One thing that will be fascinating to watch is how the final report from the commission differs from these draft materials. One of the commissioners is already saying that she doesn't think the draft materials adequately reflect the differences of opinion on the commission. So, Kim, I mean, between now and when the final copy comes out, how much jockeying do you think there is going to be behind the scenes to change these conclusions?
Well, if Sheldon Whitehouse has anything to do with it, there'll be a lot of it. You know, he's been one of the chief intimidators of the court, one of the big promoters of court packing and other changes. And he was obviously furious at the result of this, said that the report was a huge disappointment. You had groups like Demand Justice, which is a progressive outside activist organization, blasting it on Twitter and in other forums. And all of that is clearly aimed at trying to influence the final draft. One of the commissioners, in fact, the co-chair of the commissioner, is Bob Bauer, who is a Biden advisor. And it could be that he was attempting to keep this from being too big of a court packing document, just in order to shield the White House a little bit from having to even go down that road. But there's going to be enormous pressure now for there to be big changes between this draft and the final one, and to come out much more aggressively. I think one of the problems they will have with that, though, is that this draft is now on the record and these statements are now on the record. And so any dramatic shift between the draft and the final report, you know, for instance, going from court packing got a lot of problems to, yay, we're all in favor of court packing, would obviously be viewed as political and really undermine any credibility such as it is that this exercise already has. So they're kind of in a tough place.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. What about another idea that is raised in this commission report that doesn't go quite as far as adding justices? And that's term limits. And the commission, at least according to these draft materials, seems friendlier to that idea. Here's a line. It says, in fact, in its survey of the existing literature on Supreme Court term limits, the commission discovered few works arguing against term limits, unquote. So, Bill, there you have it, the open and shut case. No arguments on the other side.
Yeah, well, that's not entirely right. I do agree. This is one of the pernicious influences of the commission, that it's going to lead to talk about the term limits, because that seems like a halfway house between what we have and the court packing idea. And I think this is another terrible idea. You know, the Washington Post just carried an op-ed by Judge Harvey Wilkinson. He's on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, saying it's a terrible idea, that it actually makes worse the problems that it attempts to fix. And it makes things a lot more particular. And one of the interesting things he said is that it kind of it makes the law less majestic. You know, if these guys have terms, it just kind of makes them like other politicians coming in and out. He thinks there'll be more frequent confirmation battles that will be just as inflamed. There'll be a lot more calculations. If you know that a justice is not going to be on the Supreme Court, you know, next August, you would change what you try to get before the court and so forth. So I think, again, this is one of the problems with legitimating the idea. We're going to get a lot of bad ideas, and it takes a lot of energy and effort to defeat these bad ideas.
I also like that op-ed from Judge Wilkinson. I'd pull a couple other things from it. One is that the argument you often hear for term limits is that it would give every president equal chance to appoint people to the court. And Judge Wilkins says, well, what if a justice dies or strategically retires? You could still end up with one president getting, instead of two picks, getting three or four picks. And so it doesn't really solve that problem. And then he also brings up this issue of trying to undermining the stability of the law, is maybe the way to put it. He has this line that says, it's easy to imagine strategic games the justices may be tempted to engage in, smuggling through such and such a precedent or overruling it before so-and-so leaves the bench. And if what you want is a slow development in the law, instead of jerks back and forth every 2 or 4 or 6 years, I got to say that that's one of the problems I think you'd get with term limits. I don't know, Kim, what do you make of this argument?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I also love that op-ed. And one of the broader points he made too, and it ran through a lot of his different arguments, is just that if you think that there's a problem right now with the court being politicized, you know, just imagine a situation in like this, in which he also pointed out, imagine this situation too, where you had Supreme Court justices that retire and go back to, quote, plying their trade. The notion that there's this revolving door and that they would then go back and work in some sort of business in which they would be incredibly clear about their positions and their advocacy, and it would just undermine public confidence that you go and you put on this black robe, and at that point you become this person that is not influenced by partisan politics, but is essentially focused on the law and reading the Constitution. One thing too, by the way, that he didn't get into, but I think it's no small thing, especially because this commission just seems to gloss over it, is that it's likely unconstitutional. You know, Article 3 says that federal judges, quote, hold their offices during good behavior, end quote. And that is universally understood to mean lifetime tenure. And some proponents have then said, well, there's a workaround to this little constitutional obstacle, because if that is the case, you'd obviously have to amend the Constitution. But some suggest that, well, this description of an office just means any judicial office and not necessarily Supreme Court. So you could just take Supreme Court people and boot them off and put them on a lower court after 18 years. But again, there's likely a constitutional issue, because this Constitution also makes a very clear distinction between supreme courts and inferior courts. And it And it also says the president has power to nominate ambassadors and other public ministers and consuls and judges of the Supreme Court, and then puts everyone else into a different category, which suggests that you can't just easily throw someone off the Supreme Court again without doing a fix to the Constitution. And note that any such legislation that would attempt to do that would have to sit in front of the Supreme Court, which, you know, might find a reading that is counter to what that legislation proposes. So there's a lot of issues and steps here that people are just glossing over.
But what's strange about the term limits idea, too, is, Bill, I think, as you mentioned at the top, is that Biden has said he doesn't want to do that. I mean, these commission materials came out on Friday, and on Friday, Biden took some questions from the press on the South Lawn of the White House. He was asked, do you support term limits for the Supreme Court? He said no. And so I suppose he could change his mind. And to your point, Bill, maybe this final commission report takes on a life of its own and builds popular support for this idea, and then Biden comes along. But do you suppose that he's gotten what he wanted so far out of this commission, which is getting him out of a tight spot in the middle of the 2020 campaign and muddying the waters?
Yeah, I think there's an argument for that. He wanted to kick it down the can. Again, the difference is that when he was, you know, a couple of months ago when he was president, he was talking about being the next FDR, this transformational president. Now he's having trouble persuading his own party to pass his domestic agenda. And, you know, there's a lot of things Joe Biden said he opposes, like federal mandates, that he's changed his mind on. What I worry is just in general, the commission has fed the appetite and help legitimize these ideas. And again, term limits, I can see having a superficial populist appeal, you know, that these guys wouldn't have lifetime tenure and so forth. But I think the consequences would be awful. And we'll see whether progressives let it go or whether this this commission report, however it turns out, is just the beachhead for, you know, new assaults on the Supreme Court.
In the meantime, the Supreme Court began its new term a couple of weeks ago with some big cases on the docket. Kim, is there one in particular that you have your eye on that you're watching?
Yes, absolutely. I have been watching New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, which is going to be heard on November 3rd. And the background to this is really notable in that you'll remember that the Supreme Court's last major Second Amendment opinion was in 2008. It's Heller ruling, which did find an individual right to possess a firearm. But it hasn't really done anything since then. And the court was actually even a little bit annoyed because it had a case in recent years that also dealt with New York and the question of whether or not you could transport licensed handguns outside of the city. And in the run-up to that ruling, the city repealed the ban, therefore denying the court the ability to rule. And that really set off some of the justices like Kavanaugh and Alito and Thomas, who've really been pushing for another big case because they're very concerned that lower courts are now just making stuff up as they go because the high court has not issued further guidance. So in this New York case, it's a very big question. The technical thing it's ruling on is whether or not New York's concealed carry permit process is unconstitutional. But more broadly, what the court is being asked to decide is whether or not individuals simply have the right to carry a pistol outside of the home for self-defense. And New York at the moment is what is called a may issue state, which means that even if applicants go through all of the background checks and pass all of the tests, they still have to put forward an argument about why they have a special need for self-protection. And then a judge gets to rule on that. And most often those applications are simply denied. This is in contrast to a lot of states, which are what are called shall issue states, where if you pass all the tests and have a clean records, you are issued a permit. So this is what the court's going to examine, and it has the potential to really, really offer a lot more important guidance about the protections of Heller and limits on laws that cut against that.
Bill, how about you? Is there one case you've had your eye on for the upcoming Supreme Court term?
Well, the big one, I think, is the case on the Mississippi law on abortion. Recently the headlines have all been focused on this Texas law because of its sort of unusual approach in allowing people to sue people who've had or supplied abortions. But the case that's going to the Supreme Court that they're going to argue on December 1 is very clear cut. It's a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade. And it asks whether all restrictions on abortion before viability are unconstitutional. This one, in the case of Mississippi law, sets the limit at 15 weeks. And though it has some exceptions, it basically bans abortions after 15 weeks. So it's a direct confrontation. You know, a lot of people say it's against Roe v. Wade. In fact, it's really about Casey. In an unusual sense, in 1992, the court basically took the outcome of Roe, but gutted the rest of the ruling and came up with a new rationale for it. So all this has been coming for some time. The difference now is with Amy Comey Barrett and a kind of a 6-3 conservative majority. Does this mean a real change in the constitutional landscape? Because if it even brushes back Roe a little bit, allow states to impose some restrictions, I think it will have a tremendous effect. In my mind, it would get the issue back to where it belongs, to the American people, decided through their elected representatives. And what we can see from all these laws coming forward is that there's an appetite for it. Neither Roe nor Casey really solved this issue. So we'll be watching to see what the Supreme Court does with it now that they've agreed to take it on.
The case that I would highlight is called Carson versus Macon, and it's a school choice case being heard on December 8th. And the basics are that around half of Maine's school districts don't run their own high schools. They have a tuition assistance program, and parents can choose a private school, and then the district pays tuition up to a certain point. But the proviso is that parents and students are not allowed to choose religious schools. At some point, I think in the 1980s, Maine passed a law saying that a student's choice of school must be non-sectarian in accordance with the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. And the parents, the students are saying, well, what about the other half of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, which is freedom of religion? And they have some case law behind them. There was a Supreme Court decision last year out of Montana on tax credit scholarships, similar sort of situation. Parents going to a religious school wanted to access those, and the state said they were not allowed. And here's a line from the Chief Justice's majority opinion in that case. A state need not subsidize private education, but once a state decides to do so, it cannot disqualify some private schools solely because they are religious. So there are some distinctions there because, maybe some private schools, that's the line from Chief Justice, does not apply if you're excluding all religious schools. But I have a hard time thinking that the main, people who are defending the main law are going to find a receptive audience at the Supreme Court in December. One final thing before we go here, I wanted to call listeners' attention to is Justice Thomas. Historically, he has been silent from the bench. The big change was during the pandemic. The Supreme Court went to teleconference arguments, and they, in order to keep the chatter down, they would call, Chief Justice would call on each of his colleagues in order of his seniority. And so we heard a lot from Justice Thomas, and now the Supreme Court is back in person, and yet they've adopted this kind of hybrid argument format where they're still keeping a section of the argument where they're going in order of seniority. And the result, Kim, is in person from the bench, we have heard more questions from Justice Thomas than in a long, long time.
Right, which is really great because he's just really good. And, it really very much allows to hear from a person who is one of the best thinkers on the court. I mean, the court has a lot of great thinkers, but he's a force. And so it's been good to hear. And it does seem that part of it is a result of this new altered oral argument format that he maybe perhaps feels more comfortable with.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.